Friday meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2082. We're considering the Dash 1 amendments which replace the bill. We had quite a bit of testimony on this at our first hearing on it, which was Wednesday, and we'll be continuing that because we didn't get to everybody that wanted to testify then, and then we also have some new people who signed up today. So our first witness we'll hear from will be Jason Williams. Morning. Thanks for being so patient.
For you guys, all the patients in the world. But, members of committee, Chair Rosenbaum, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I know that here to testify against House Bill 2082, and I know that people make mistakes. I kind of made one this week. I sent out a letter asking people to call their lawmakers to the toll-free 800 number, but I missed a digit, and I think I had them call a gating service.
I hope that worked out.
Yeah, well, the donations among single people has been up at the Taxpayer Association. But that's kind of what I want to lead with is about mistakes, and with the first part of the bill about being able to help senior citizens and people who leave missing information on sheets, people who make mistakes, and our ability to correct them. And I think it affects seniors the most. And so I've got a handout that has a bunch of examples of some sheets that came in here, and I'll wait till everyone gets them. But the thing is that all we want to do is just help protect that name from being disqualified because of a mistake that they may have made. And a lot of ours come in the mail, so we don't have the ability to ask them if they are handicapped. But if I can go to Exhibit A in the handout, here's a case of someone sending in a petition. You can see Gene Carey. Now, that's not his full name. His name is actually Harold Carey. So he starts out with a problem there, meaning that if they can't find him, sometimes they will look on his address. But if you look at his address is really screwed up. His handwriting is very, very poor. In fact, if you look at the zip code, his zip code looks nothing like what it really is. So you have a person who, this man would be likely stricken from the record just because of his poor handwriting. And because, now we know who he is because, well, he signed down at the bottom as the witness. Okay. A little bit overload of lobbyists. But we can see from the sheet that, it looks like it's all filled out down there. But if the person didn't know who's verifying the signature, well, not only do we lose his name, but then that counts against us, and then there's dozens of other names that get taken out of the penalty. So that's a case of a legitimate voter being knocked out. So if we go on to Exhibit B, here's a person, Mr. Real. Just a very difficult address to read. Well, we can detect this address because all we need to do is look at the letter it came in and verify it off the voter file. And this person also sent in two petitions where his other petition was a little bit more clear. But here's a case where this person would have been disenfranchised, has a likely chance of being disenfranchised, and if he gets disenfranchised, he'll take dozens of voters with him in the penalty. Exhibit C, we have an example of the person they didn't put in the city. And we would just feel very natural to help honor that person's name. We would fill in the city for them. Exhibit D is just another example of this person's address being very difficult. And sometimes it's just one letter or just one number that would help that person to be clear and protect that person's signature. We go on to Exhibit E. Now, here's a problem that comes in all the time. It's people writing in quotation marks and the letters, saying. You know, husband and wives, people live in the same house. You'll see that on Exhibit E. You'll see that on Exhibit F. And we would prefer to be able to, fill in that information, verify that they're there, and fill in the information so that they don't get disqualified. Exhibit G is a person they didn't even bother to put any quotation marks, or they just didn't do the address. We don't want that person to be lost because they decided to not put their address down. For Exhibit H, that's where the quotation marks come in. And this is where another issue that Representative Greenlich brought up this week about the date rule. If you could see down there, this person, for whatever reason, bolded in their number 7. Were they starting on another number? We don't know. Was their first number 7 wrong? But because they bolded in that number 7, likely this entire page would be voided just because they bolded in that number 7 because it looks like someone wrote over something. So, when you add all of those examples up, you're talking thousands and thousands of legitimate names and voters being stricken from the roll. Another example of the bolding, Exhibit I. And here's a case where the guy most likely wrote in 60606 for, it's a proper way of putting June 6 of 06. Well, he put a dash over the O, which would likely put this guy, have him be pulled from the, have the sheet pulled, and any names on the sheet would become void. And I say likely because, I mean, it's a determining factor, but we've seen a lot of these type of examples happen. Exhibit J is kind of an example with a date rule. Here's an example where they accidentally signed in 07. Well, it's obvious that the person signed in 06 because there's only one person who signed the sheet and they signed it above, but because they signed 07, they just wrote over the 7 with a 6. Well, it's virtually impossible that for him to put 07 on there for that to have happened, so it makes sense for him to correct it by putting 06, and this would be another likely case where the name would be thrown out and we would be penalized. And the last one, Exhibit K, I thought was kind of interesting because here's a person where the husband and wife signed on August 1st, and I don't know what they wrote the 1 over, but whatever they wrote the 1 over, it couldn't be that bad because whatever number they would have put in between those brackets would have qualified it. Because if they signed it on the 1st, it doesn't matter if they signed it when they witnessed it from the 1st to the 31st, any number would have been credible. So that's a case where it's, in my mind, it's impossible for them to have made a mistake. But just by bolding that, they did make a mistake, and this likely would have been thrown out and canceled. And, you know, when we talk about fraud, I mean, for that to be an example, a case of fraud, it would mean that the wife would have snuck in, Dorothy would have snuck in without her husband's permission and signed it, and then to conceal her activities would have written in the date. And it's just, it's those situations that kind of, you know, make the process way more difficult than it should be, and it ends up having 5,000-10,000 signatures that just get disqualified. So that I wanted to kind of give some updates on the date issue and also just show you real-life examples of, you know, and a lot of these people, when I looked them up, I mean, they are 70s and their 80s. These are people who forget to put in a city or don't write legibly, and all we wanted to be able to do is have the ability to go in there and write it in. And a lot of these come in mail, so we can see their address, return address, right on the envelope. So it makes perfect sense. We could verify it against the voter roll. But having to call back and say, hey, we can fix this only if you can tell us that you're physically or mentally handicapped, those aren't the type of phone calls I want to be able to make. I want to be able to do what I can to help them without trying to figure out if they are in the handicap or if they are just wrote illegibly. And the issue about not putting things in there, and I'm not quite sure the committee has taken it up, but I'm not quite sure from my reading of the bill if this allows us to cross out names who we know are not voters. If someone signs and they're from Canada, do we have the right to cross out the name? Because we would not want to put a false name in their voter roll.
Jason, do you see something in the bill that would prevent that?
In the original.
Chair,
Have you looked at the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes.
Because that's what we're working off of now.
The issue, if we can have the ability to eliminate a duplicate, then I think that's another case where we want to be able to cross out. Well, then I see sort of a double standard where we can help someone if it's a duplicate, but we can't help someone if they make one type of mistake but not the other. So, but if the amendments, if it's clear for this committee that the amendments do allow for non-voters and duplicates and or even people who have don't even sign, then we appreciate that very much. The second thing that I'd like to address in the committee is the not allowing people to copy blank petitions and the sequentially numbered. I feel like this gets to the very heart of what petitions are about. They're about neighbors going to neighbors, making copies. We have a copy machine in our office, and I can't tell you how many times I've got to go run to that copy machine to make copies at the last minute. And I don't see anything wrong with that. People show up at my door. I mean, when you're the chief petitioner, your address is on the back. So people feel free to come by at 8:30 at night or 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and they want petitions. And sometimes you only have one petition under your couch, and you just get say, hey, here's one. Here's how you copy it. In some ways, you're kind of like, oh, geez, this is kind of weird, but it's democracy, and you feel the flow of people expressing themselves, and I would just hate to enter into the issue of the not allowing people to copy blank petitions and sequentially numbering. I have not exactly figured out why they need to be sequentially numbered, so I would like maybe the committee to address that. I did have a conversation with one staffer about, you know, this would help prevent people from the paid signature gatherers who take, who collect signatures and then go try to find the highest bidder. And I don't see, it doesn't understand to me, so it's hard for me to, I don't understand, see how that would affect that. Furthermore, that is a problem. People who paid signature gatherers, there's a few, but I would not want to punish 100% of my volunteers by restricting them for the actions of five or six boneheads who try to take advantage of the system. And I think that there are other ways to fix that particular problem. Finally, the issue about getting 10,000 signatures before you get a ballot title, I think that places an undue burden on for the small mom-and-pop volunteer organizations. And I think this, speaking of duplicates, I think that raises the issue of duplicates, because if you have a measure, like let's say there was campaign finance reform, well, they circulated two measures that were very similar. So now, if they circulate two measures that are very similar, then they get their 10,000 signatures, now they have to get a new petition sheet that looks different and go back and circulate two very sounding similar petitions. So now you have four petitions that seem somewhat similar. Well, you're going to have people that are going to sign the name twice. And so you're going to be inviting people almost to, I mean, it's just not, it just creates way too much of an open door for people to sign twice. And it gets back to why do we need to do that 10,000 threshold? The issue last week or a few days ago was the issue of, you know, because some people ballot title shop. Well, that's not the only reason why there's a lot of people taking the cases to the courts. Sometimes they go to the courts because the attorney general does a ballot title that's just not representative, and they're not perfect. So there's some court costs that are just because of what the attorney general does. There are some court costs because of what some people like to sue every time their opponents, you know, put a measure up there, because it delays when they could go to the street. And, you know, we really can't stop that. It's their right to do that. But as the AG's office said yesterday, I mean, the big burden is not with their office, but with the courts. And so some of the things that affect the courts are out of the control of what the petitioners can do. And so if we put a 10,000 threshold limit, it's really going to punish the petitioners for the actions of what other people are doing, whether right or wrong. And I don't think that is good policy. In conclusion, I would really just emphasize with the blank petition sheets, I cannot explain that to voters as people are asking me about it. And I don't know how you guys are going to be able to explain it, but I need to at least know what are the reasons for it, so I can at least explain to my people, and when it, if it does become law, why is this, you know, what's the overarching reason? So, anyways, those are the things, and hope you enjoy the exhibits and be glad to answer any questions.
Sure, I'll entertain questions in a moment. I was going to ask you, though, were you at our first hearing where we had testimony about some of the things that are currently going on out there?
Yes.
And you heard testimony from some people who said that they had observed signature gatherers who would ask people to just sign their name multiple times. People would think that they were signing the same thing more than once, and it would turn out that they were signing on different initiatives that they weren't even aware of. And so I think that some of what this proposal is intended to do is have people actually looking at those sheets as they're filling out the rest of the information. And you said that you had other ideas for how to fix some of these problems, and we would be happy to entertain any suggestions that are not contained in these bills as well.
Yes, Chair, members of the committee. Well, the one of them that already is in the bill with the getting rid of the counties. And I think that that would save a lot of paperwork, a lot of time, and that's a modernization.
Mm-hmm.
Also with, you know, not allowing people guilty of forgery and identity theft, having them not to be able to circulate paid petitions. I think that's a great idea. So, you know, those are some of the ideas that are already out there. There's some big poisonous elements I see in it that it's just like, hey, you got to remove those first, because if you make it so difficult that the average person, you know, an average volunteer effort cannot pass it, I feel like we've really lost something.
Mm-hmm. Questions from committee members. Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you. A comment, if you'll indulge me first. Jason, my staff thanks you for your error last night on calls.
Oh.
My question is this. On the 10,000 signatures, or 10%, whatever, it's currently 25 signatures. Would you agree that that seems sort of low, or do you think 25 is just fine and we should continue with the same standard?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Berger, I think it's fine. I mean, for me, going out and getting those 25 sponsor signatures, I mean, it does take... I mean, it takes a half a day to do it, so it's no easy thing. Just because you got to go and get the people from Wright County, go to the elections office, you got to get them approved from the county elections offices before you can then turn them in. I think maybe if you want to focus in on the issue of whether it's too easy to do that, or whether it's too easy to put in too many measures, if you wanted to consider something where if a person puts in a lot of measures where they need to start having a fee or something like that, then I might be open to that. But I don't see it having to get 25 sponsorship signatures. It's just fine.
Wouldn't you say, though, that a fee is sort of contrary to this volunteer initiative? It seems to me, and I haven't done this, and that's why you're in the chair and I'm not, answering these questions, that if you are a chief petitioner and you are ballot shopping, you can go to the same 25 people. And get multiple times, keep resubmitting until you get a ballot title. And that seems like a very low standard. On the other hand, imposing a fee is a fee on direct democracy, which is what we're talking about here, and the initiative petition system, and that seems like a very contrary notion to what the whole philosophical basis of is, you know, ordinary citizens and not having to pay to participate. Just my kind of take on the thing.
Yes, Chair Representative Berger. But I just see it as part of participatory democracy. That is, I mean, when a whole bunch of people decide to run for office all in the same, you know, seat, that drives up the cost. But the state says, hey, we'll pick up the cost for when people want to participate in democracy. And so I just see it as just a cost that the cost of democracy.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. Actually, Representative Berger asked one of my questions. My other question, I guess maybe my comment would be, when we normal regular people, I think most of us are normal regular people, decide to run for office, we have to pay a filing fee to do that. or we have to get a certain number of signatures. So I'm wondering if that, something like that, a combination where either you get a little bit higher threshold of signatures or you pay a fee to file a ballot, if that's something you've ever considered. It's kind of like what candidates do.
Chair, Representative Thatcher, I haven't really considered that much. I really don't feel, there's 100 measures or so that get filed. That to me doesn't seem like very much. It is minuscule compared to the entire business that the Attorney General's office, the Elections Office, does. It seems to be making a problem where there really isn't one. So, for me, I'd rather focus on just making. You could save a lot of time and paperwork by getting rid of the county rule and getting rid of the date issue. That will save a lot of time and money.
And I was just reminded, though, that the testimony we heard the other day was that about 60 measures have already been filed, and we're not even in the height of the season. So it looks like we're on track to maybe exceed what you just said by quite a bit. Other questions? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been actually a very interesting morning already. I've got a view of Mr. Williams filing petitions under his sofa. Representative Thatcher actually referred to a Liberal Democrat as a normal person. So I think this has been a very revelatory morning. Mr. Williams, do you make use of the Internet at all? The issue kit had come up about petitions being sent over the Internet, being able to be downloaded, printed, and mailed back. Does your organization participate in that?
Chair, Representative Buckley, no. We try to do a lot of ideas. Like one of my genius ideas was to take a petition sheet and, make it 11 by or 8 by 14, and have this part be what you mail to the people, so it folds as a self-mailer, and you mail it right into people, and they just reverse fold and mail it back out. And we just cut off the part there, but, we couldn't do that. So there's a lot of things that we would like to do, but we can't. And maybe fully justified in their decision. But I would love to be able to see, especially off the Internet, just being able to go to a place, download the petition with instructions. I think it'd be fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your testimony. And our next witness is Greg Wasson. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Wasson. I have degrees in journalism, political science, and law from the University of Oregon, and spent 10 years as a member of the Capitol Press Corps downstairs. I've spent most of the last 15 years thinking about, reading about, and writing about the initiative process and the history of the initiative in Oregon and nationally. The adoption of the initiative in 1902 provided a way that Oregon became the first state in the Union to elect its U.S. senators at the polls. 5 years later, the 17th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution spread direct election nationwide. So essentially, a bunch of well-educated Joes in Oregon City facilitated the amendment of the federal Constitution. I find that an inspiring story, and I find it a scandal that I grew up in Oregon, had 3 degrees from the University of Oregon, and had to teach myself that story. I think it's a blot on the governmental institutions and the civic institutions of this state that I didn't learn that story when I was 7 years old. My father taught history in Oregon grade schools, and he didn't know that story. Most of the last 2 months have found me in the law library researching the interplay between the federal constitution and state statutes regulating signature collection. My main reason for appearing today is to point to what I think are federal constitutional issues raised by HB 2082, and urge the committee to return to the rolling 2-year limitation that Senator Atkinson mentioned on Wednesday. First, I would like to remind the committee that there are two groups of people using the initiative in this state. People who want to run this state by the initiative and regular citizens who get excited about one issue or the other. And as you heard on Wednesday, the impact of the regulations on the signature collection process fall much harder on the second group of people than the first. People who actively are using the initiative process are aware of what pitfalls have been placed in their way, and in true simplified status are able to adapt and overcome. The average citizen doesn't find out about the what I consider dubious regulations until they get in the middle of an initiative process. If that costs them money, costs them energy, or prevents them from getting on the ballot, the government has formed another enemy. We just spent a year figuring out how can we get the citizens to like the legislature better. Right? Well, this is a way that you can get the citizens not to dislike the legislature, is not placing new rules in their way. I also would like to offer my take on why William S. Wren created the initiative process in the first place. He wasn't interested in creating some dialogue between the citizens and the government. He was interested in taking over the government because he wanted to institute a confiscatory tax scheme that he knew he could never get by this building. So he created a second parallel legislative body in hopes that he could get his radical tax scheme, which smelled of socialism and was un-American at its core. But remember, this was before the Soviet Union showed just how bad an idea communism was. Oregon was real close to becoming the Republic of Oregon. If Wren had had his way, it would be the Republic of Oregon. But and so, in other words, the original initiative amendment, which has never been legally changed, there was an amendment in 1968, but it just had to do with language changes and didn't change the structure of the initiative amendment. So the structure of the initiative amendment is to give a small group of people control over the government. I think it's a mark of the brilliance of Wren that 100 years later, his tools are still having the effect that he desired. So I would urge this committee to return to the basic structure of the initiative itself and bring it up to date. As I say, I've spent the last 2 months doing research on the history the federal constitution's interplay with state statutes regulating signature collection. While states are under no federal obligation to create an initiative system, once they do, the federal constitution comes in to protect it. One of the federal constitutional tests is, does this regulation of the signature collection process, is it necessary? Before we get to the point of whether it's a severe restriction or a little restriction, the first question is it necessary? There were only 10 initiatives on the ballot in November, and only two of them passed. One preventing the government from condemning private property and giving it to another private person, and the second extended participation in the state discounted drug program. Not approved. A series of initiatives sponsored by out-of-state money, not that there's anything wrong with that, but so I don't see the problem. The fact that people get to vote acts as a check on any skullduggery in the signature collection process. I have probably voted against 19 of the last 20 statewide initiatives that I've been presented with. And yet, I would go to my grave defending the right of those people to put those on the ballot. Going to the two-year rolling limitation on the Constitution, right now the two-year limit on initiative petitions runs from July before the November election to July before the November election 2 years later. That's not the Constitution. The Secretary of State just made it up one day. It's just the same as if Bill Bradbury passed an administrative rule that said the legislature cannot meet on February 16th, stood at the steps of the Capitol and said, you can't come to work today. Because I have an administrative rule that limits a constitutional creation. That violates everything I ever learned about how constitutions are supposed to work in America. But, okay, let's take that two-year limit, say everybody's used to it, so, you know, I have no problem. If someone takes 10 years to gather signatures, would you rather support that proposal or someone who was able to buy signatures in a month? Which one do you think is more legitimate? But the two-year period, people have gotten used to it, so let's put it in the Constitution where it'll be legal. This would be taking that static limit and making it rolling so that my 2 years didn't start to run until I was actually certified to hit the streets. Right now, everybody's chasing signatures at the same time. So as the deadline approaches, the cost that you have to pay to get people together signatures goes up. If that period were rolling instead of static, that commercial activity would be reduced, even to the point, I would argue, that these national petition mills would leave Oregon off their dance card because they wouldn't be able to make the money that they're used to making under the current system. Also, that static two-year period is making people challenge ballot titles, not because they have a problem with the ballot title, but because they're trying to tie up their opponents in court and keep them off the street. Well, if it were a rolling two-year limit instead of a static two-year limit, that motivation would be reduced significantly. And the Supreme Court would be presented with fewer busy work. And the august body of the Supreme Court being used as a tool in political battles. If we want our judicial system to issue judicial decisions, then we need to keep as much politics out of the structure of that body as we can. Because as Wayne Morris said, if I control your procedural rights, I control your substantive rights. And so, also, having the two-year limit rolling would spread the workload of the Attorney General and Secretary of State out over a year, rather than having it crammed into a two-week process every other year. It makes the impact of that limit the same, no matter when in the two-year cycle I start collecting signatures. If I don't get upset with the government until a year and a half into that election cycle, then by the time I've done all the processes, I'm left with maybe 2 months to collect signatures, 3 months to collect signatures. Laws are supposed to apply equally in this country. And that obviously is not an equal application. Also consider if our object is to keep issues off the ballot, then it would make sense for us to encourage citizens to work with the legislature. Because if the legislature gives them what they want, then they don't have to go to the ballot. But right now, the static two-year limit works against people working with the legislature. Because as the open primary people had a press conference Wednesday, said they're working with the legislature, but if they don't get what they want out of the legislature, they'll go to the ballot in 2008. But the static two-year limit works against them doing that because for them to work with the legislature means that they're going to have less time to gather signatures. Now, sophisticated people like Nora Paulus and Phil Kiesling can deal with that. But the more average citizen, I would argue, shouldn't be faced with that choice. In closing, I just would say that the initiative system is broken. It's got problems, but the problems come from the fact that the original amendment was designed not to make people work with the government, but to control and hassle the government. And that if we address those structural issues, that many of these problems would disappear. And so I have copies of the draft that Elsie gave on this rolling two-year limit. And I would encourage the committee to introduce it as a committee bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for this witness? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Excellent testimony, and I'm really grateful you brought this forward. And I would appreciate a copy of the LC draft. I don't think we have one here, but that would be good. On page 4 of your written testimony, there was a section that I don't think you touched on, which was just basically to clarify the two legitimate concerns of signature gathering. And I just wanted to, I think this is very important in my discussion with colleagues. It seems like this is what we're trying to focus on as well. Verifying that a voter actually supports holding a public vote on the idea, and secondly, verifying that the voter is who the voter says they are. That's the purpose. That's what we're all trying to get to. And I just wanted to point that out as part of your written testimony.
Yeah, and I work better without a script.
You did great.
I think it's important because, you know, if my signature's there, that means I support holding that election. And all the other stuff is just superfluous. And I don't want the people telling me what to do any more than I want the legislature telling me what to do. But it just pisses me off when people tell me what to do, especially if there's no reason for them to tell me to do that.
Spoken like a true Oregonian, I got to say. Can I just clarify, Madam Chair, can I clarify?
Yes, follow up.
On the rolling two-year period, just so I have it absolutely clear, you're suggesting that once I'm set, I've gone through the whole process, I'm ready to hit the streets. That's when the clock starts that day. So if it's February 16th of 2007, I have until February 16th of 2009 to get my signature.
Yes, and in fact, you know, the thing is that change will fit in with any other change that you make in the system. Because any other change you make in the system that adds to the time the government is dealing with my initiative petition is going to penalize me. So it sort of put some structure in the system that allows you to make those changes without penalizing citizens.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Buck.
Berger. Well, mine is just a comment, Madam Chair, an appreciation of this testimony and your clear research and devotion to this process, but I just have to comment that I too went to public school in Oregon, and I was taught that Oregon was central in this, and I don't remember specifically, but I know I knew it by junior high, so presumably it was fourth grade civics.
I'm a Harrisburg boy, so you know, maybe that says something about school district 1J or whatever they
are. And Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on some of Representative Buckley's questions, with respect to the rolling, so your opinion would be that the state would then set deadlines when those petitions had to be in for any particular election, and any one of those elections that fall within that 2 year would be available, depending on if you met the time for getting the petitions in?
Well, we're getting into a whole nother question. I mean, the Constitution says that the biennial general election will be held every other November, and that initiatives are to be given to the people at general elections. A general election and a biennial general election are two different things.
Yeah.
And yet the Secretary of State either reads biennial out of Article 2, Section 8, I don't remember what it is, or puts biennial into Article 4, Section 1. He doesn't have the power to do either of those things. But the problem is that if he were to deal with this body the way he deals with the popular legislature, your lawyers would be over across the street in a minute. But the initiative system doesn't have a lawyer. I've sort of decided that the reason I was born was to be the initiative system. if the government, one arm of the government does something to the initiative system, where do I go to get relief? To another arm of the government. Now, if the court gets too weird, you're going to cut off their money. I mean, that's the infighting of the separation of powers. I go to circuit court. They don't talk Constitution circuit court, so I get denied. Then I go to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirms without opinion. The Supreme Court refuses to consider, so I have never been told why my ideas are invalid. But the only people who care are me and my mother, because Committee for Petition Rights is me and one other person at this point. But, you know, taking a hint from Mark Twain, just start painting the fence and see who joins in.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. I've thoroughly enjoyed your testimony. Thank you. I could probably listen to you for another period of time. But I was also thinking this morning about our federal constitution and how recently, a couple of weeks ago, I don't remember the date, we had a class of law
high school
students. Students come in and talk about how our constitution in Oregon required that in order to vote in school board elections, you had to read and write English, among other requirements. And I'm thinking, well, that's kind of what's being required here in this proposed amendment, that people would be able to read and write English. And I'm just wondering if you would have any comments.
Well,
on that.
I think that's a legitimate point, and I have problems with anything that is exclusionary and creating an elite class, you know. And so, but why punish someone because they weren't lucky enough to be born an American? That's But I agree with you that but we're getting a little bit. I've never done actual research on that question, so.
Or be able to see, or have dyslexia, or whatever thing that could prevent you from reading or writing English.
Well, I had it in my original testimony and struck it, but. About 25 years ago, I got into an argument with a fully loaded plywood truck, and my arm has never worked right since then. So I don't sign initiative petitions because by the time I did it, he could add three or four more signatures. I never knew that someone could put in my address. And now that I know that, I'll take advantage of it. But if that rule passes that this person can't help me that way, then I have been disenfranchised.
Although, under the provisions of this amendment, if somebody has a disability, and I'm sure the rules would address this, they can receive assistance.
But then that would mean me having to register with the government as disabled. I just as a matter of principle, don't sign stuff. The census people came to my door finally about the third time. I gave them a false name just so they'd go away. I don't like the government keeping track of me. So that's
okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll hear from Douglas Hoyer.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. I'm a citizens activist, and I'm here to oppose House Bill 2082. I like the idea of the Secretary of State conducting a class to help signature gatherers do a better job, and I would take such a class, but I'd hate to see them throw out signatures because someone didn't attend. And then to require citizens to be registered in order to collect signatures is, to me, an unnecessary obstruction on the citizens' right to petition the government or seek redresses for injustices. When a citizen supports an issue or petition, they may list the help of others to help them gather signatures. And it only serves to oppose the real grassroots efforts of signature gathering. I would also like to be able to help my neighbor make his signature count by adding information that he may have forgotten to put in. I understand the government's concern that some people have forged signatures sheets and this practice should be punished, but please don't punish those who are trying to complete the signature sheets with the correct information. Every valid signature should count. And I find that people who oppose the initiative process try various ways to restrict it, and citizens who embrace the initiative process try to make it more accessible. And Oregonians should take every step to help citizens voice their opinions and wishes by making signatures count and not by trying to invalidate the signatures. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness?
Mr. Berger.
Thank you for coming in today. You sound like, you know, those citizens we're always looking for, the ones who just use the system as it's made and try and dutifully get signatures in. And I'm just curious, your testimony doesn't speak very much to your experience. Have you done a lot of volunteer petition gathering? Are you new to this? What's your history on this, trying to do this?
Vice Chair Berger, Senator Rosenbaum, or Representative Rosenbaum. I haven't had much experience actually gathering signatures, not in the recent past. In years ago, I have. But I'm always for the grassroots efforts and trying to get issues in front of the government. And I see the initiative process as one of the best ways for disgruntled citizens to get their opinion up where they normally can't get it across to the legislature.
Follow up. I would suggest to you, sir, that the other way is to call your state representative. And judging from your address, I'm it. I'd be happy to hear from you at any time.
Thank you.
Great. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. Thank you for testimony. As someone who's just as a citizen, the idea that we've helped to bring about an industry to gather signatures, does that have any concerns for you, or do you see a distinction between requiring some sort of identification or regulation of the paid signature gathering effort as opposed to the volunteer effort?
I really don't know too much about the industry of gathering signatures. I realize that the money's there for them, but I think some of that comes from the restrictions that are being imposed. And the last speaker was eloquent on that point, I guess.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here. And next we'll hear from Renee Kimball.
Good morning. Thank you all for taking the time to hear what I have to say. My name is Renee Kimball, and my husband and I came up from Portland. And first, I would like to help you understand how important this issue is to me. I have a 91-year-old friend who suffered a massive heart attack and stroke 2 weeks ago, and has subsequently refused food and is about days or hours from death. And I left her side to be here. So I hope you understand how important this is, not just to me, but to all the people who didn't leave their friend's side to be here today. Why did my father fight in World War II? Why did my teacher's husband die in Korea? Why did I lose 7 high school friends in Vietnam? Why were we in Bosnia, Kuwait, and why did my neighbor's grandson die in Iraq? Because they believed that we had something to protect, HB 2082 takes that faith and diminishes it to a worthless triviality. This bill says we, the people, are so corrupt and so stupid, we would be incapable of photocopying a blank petition correctly. HB 2082 forces all petitions to be sequentially numbered and printed by the state, adding more bureaucracy and problems to a very straightforward process. Will having a sequential number prevent an unscrupulous person from willingly signing a bill more than once? HB 2082 would prevent petition gatherers from helping a senior citizen or someone who was in a hurry when they forgot to put in a zip code. It would also force handicapped people to label themselves as handicapped before they could get help. This is both unkind and unfair. This bill says that we, the people, are so befuddled we don't know we want a bill without having 10,000 of us say yes twice. First to get a title, and then to get it on the ballot. While this bill has some apparent merits to it, it has a good feeling behind it. It wants to prevent corruption. It wants to stop people from doing the wrong thing. It really basically restricts our freedom as we the people to have a say in how we're going to be governed. We respect you. We respect you enough to have elected you. And if we're smart enough to elect you to the position you hold, then we are smart enough to know when we want to have laws changed and we want to have new ones implemented. If the founders entrusted the people with the power to nullify any law in this land by voting not guilty on a jury trial, then surely you can trust us with the initiative process. I urge you, for the sake of your legislative integrity, to please vote HB 2082 down. It's just a bad idea. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions, Vice Chair Berger?
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony, and I appreciate the vehemence and the dedication of your being here, truly. One of the reasons that we have, if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair, just a moment, these opportunities is for you to come forward, and I would submit to you that by your being here and by us being here, it gives us a chance to make this, to hear this bill and make it better. It isn't a done deal until we're done here. So join with us, please, and in suggesting which parts, either by email or by written testimony, you agree with and which parts you don't, because just yay or nay leaves us with the bill as written. And I think that from the previous testimony, at least I hear a lot of ways to make it better. So to that end, there is a question at the end of this, which is, what is your personal experience? This is the same question I asked the previous testifier. Have you been out gathering signatures on various issues, and what is your sort of response to, I really think the parts in here that you object to are around this fraud issue. And I think you'd agree that if there is fraud, it's not a good thing. So, I mean, have you been circulating petitions, and do you have any suggestions for how we can protect this system? Did you hear the discussion on the two-year rolling?
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Tell me what your take on that with regard to whatever experience you've had, because I frankly have never circulated a petition.
Okay.
So I'm here to listen to people who have.
I have circulated a few petitions that I really strongly believe in, and I've done that door-to-door, you know, in our neighborhood, and I've gone to friends of mine. I've also signed any number of petitions, and I've been very adamant about knowing and reading the petition before I signed it, not just the little blurb at the top of the sheet here, sign your name and do whatever. I've actually gone into the bill and asked the person who is circulating the petition. So I like to know what I'm signing for, not just what the person's telling me I'm signing for. And when I do that with other people, I carry a copy of the thing with me. Mm-hmm. And so here it is. You don't have to trust my word. Here it is. I'll show you. I'll help you understand what's going on. So I don't do it that much, just on certain ones that I become involved in and actually do believe very strongly in. As far as making it better, I'd like to be able to offer that in writing to you and make suggestions and offer also my testimony in writing. It's rather...
That's fine.
...at the moment. But, if we didn't have faith in your ability to do this properly, believe me, I would have been first in line preventing you from getting there. So, have faith in us that we are willing to stand up and say to you, this is how to make it better, and this stuff is really dangerous. And there's a lot in this bill that just says, okay, Renee, shut up, sit down, and take what we tell you to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we would certainly be happy to receive your comments.
Thank you for coming.
And I believe now we will hear from John Lindbeck.
Good morning, and thanks for your patience.
Ouch.
The bottle's getting bigger.
Almost as big as the amendment.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have to say that I totally enjoyed these hearings, and it's been fun watching the looks on your faces, because the sort of net effect of all that you're hearing is welcome to my world, because this is what I hear all the time, diametrically opposed views on how to deal with the initiative system. And I'd like to propose an amendment to the bill here at the table, and it would say all members of the House and Senate Rules Committees are required to report to the Elections Division in July of even-numbered years to assist the Elections Division between the hours of 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. in sorting in excess of 310,000 initiative signature sheets.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
John Lindbeck, Director of Elections, Secretary of State's Office. To continue, and preparing 1.7 million signatures for the verification process in the course of 2 weeks. I offer this obviously in jest, but because I sincerely wish you could all participate so that you could get a taste of what it is like for us to be a referee in this process. And I think that you've already gotten a taste of that, hearing the views that are so different from different members of the community in Oregon. But when it comes to July of even-numbered years, turn up the volume about 100%, because the emotions are running high. People have spent a lot of time gathering signatures, and they are desperate to get these things on the ballot. They're desperately afraid they're not going to make it. And they have lawyers poised to sue at the drop of a hat. There's not a day that goes by in July and an even-numbered year when somebody doesn't threaten to sue the state, sue the Secretary of State's office. That is the environment in which we operate. We bring down to the lobby center in the basement, if you were to join us, and you are welcome. boxes full of petition sheets, one petition at a time, and our staff reviews each and every sheet. Is each sheet from the correct petition? Sometimes we get them mixed up. We have to weed those out. Was the petition sheet the approved petition sheet, complete with the ballot title and or text of the petition on the reverse side? Was it signed and dated in accordance with the rules set out in our initiative and referendum manual? Minimum, first initial, last name, not an unreasonable requirement. Date the petition that the day that you finished witnessing the signatures, not difficult, not a difficult requirement for people to follow or understand. During these reviews, particularly of controversial initiatives, each division staff member sitting around the tables has observers peering over your shoulder. Sometimes up to 3 and 4 observers per staff person, hovering over our shoulders, watching our every move and our every decision. And this is not an exaggeration. I really wish you could see this. It is truly something else. I need a staff member just to manage the observers. And we have, on occasion, had to referee disagreements between the observers. We disqualify sheets of signatures for violations of various rules, and the proponents of the initiatives, as I said, regularly threaten to sue us. But it's interesting, despite some of the things that you've been hearing about those sign and date rules, that it's so onerous to sign with a first initial and a last name, and it's so onerous to put a date on the bottom of the petition, nobody has successfully sued us over that matter, because not one single petition in the course that we've been enforcing these rules has failed to make the ballot because of them. And I guarantee you that if it had, they would be suing us and it would have been litigated by now, because that is the nature of what this process has become. It's time-consuming. It's stressful, the whole process of reviewing all those sheets, but it is absolutely necessary. If you want a process that has rules built into it to ensure fairness and integrity, there must be a referee in process that makes the players follow the rules that have been set out in statute and rule. I often remind people that these initiatives, in the course of their circulation, often pick up opposition. And we've heard a lot in this hearing from the proponents of putting initiatives on the ballot, but there are a lot of opponents of putting those initiatives on the ballot too, and they have rights, just like the proponents. And thus, we have developed this into the situation where there's almost a war zone in our office as we review the sheets, and at the county level when the signature verification process is going on. I call Multnomah County in this process ground zero, because there's just as many observers there, and the situation is equally as hot. If we don't do this, the process that now has enough fraud in it to be alarming would be so vulnerable to fraud that the public would totally lose all trust in it. And I firmly believe that we saw signs of that with the heavy vote in favor of Measure 26. The public had had enough. They didn't trust the process, and they believe the process needs to be cleaned up, and we need to take that signal very seriously. Some people call the rules, such as the requirement that each circulator sign with a minimum of their first initial or their last name, and that they date the petition after witnessing the signature, is a technicality. Denigrating the rules by calling them technicalities may be good political gamesmanship in a committee room or when talking to the press. But I'm here to tell you, as the referee in this process, and I have no stake in any of these initiatives, half the time I on purpose don't pay attention to even what they are. Fraud would be so rampant in the system that it would be out of control, and we all would be at least partially responsible for helping to destroy a system that Oregon cherishes. I'd like to address for a moment the Dash 1 amendments to our original bill. If you're going to move forward with the ballot title shopping amendments, we suggest an effective date change. Make them apply to petitions submitted for the 2010 cycle. We will need some time to make changes to our internal database system to accommodate those changes. And it's always good when you're making changes in a process like this to try to make them at the beginning of the next cycle rather than in the middle of the cycle, because I can tell you now that we already have 14 petitions for the next for this current cycle approved to circulate, and five more approvals are pending. And our understanding is most of those are indeed out on the street right now, and it's very early. And I think we're going to have a potential for a lot of initiatives on the ballot in 2008. Other comments on the Dash 1 amendments? We would prefer the original language in House Bill 2082 relating to the templates of signature sheets. The idea here, as we proposed it, was to make obtaining the approved templates less of a burden for the chief petitioners. Right now, they're required to come to us with templates that they put together. We say, not good enough, they go back, try it again. We say, not good enough, they go back, try it again. Why don't we just do it for them? And that way, we will make sure that it's done correctly. In our original version of the bill, there was a time limit for us to do that so that we couldn't drag our feet. I just think it makes a lot of sense for the chief petitioners. I talked to a couple of them in the hall after the hearing, and I just don't think that they realized that that was the intent of our original bill. It was to make life easier for them, not more onerous for them, and I think once they understood, they were warmer to the original version. We are supportive of the language that would bar someone with a forgery conviction in their background from being paid to gather signatures in Oregon. In regards to the criminal background checks, if we are required to do those up front before someone can begin circulating signatures, it will require some financial resources for our division. And I don't know how you want to deal with that issue. I'm hearing that there are some options people are discussing. But that is one thing that would be a factor for us, is if we're gonna do it and we're gonna pay for it, and it's gonna be up front in the process, that's a potential financial issue for us. I'd also like to speak up for the proposal that we provide training to circulators that was in our original bill. It was deleted in the Dash 1 amendments, and our plan was simply to provide simple and clear training online, and we would provide DVDs to companies that hire circulators. The circulator would then attest when they register up front with our office that they have taken the training. I'd also like to point out here that we proposed the registration idea mainly because it would be of value to us and the chief petitioners for us to have an exemplar of each paid circulator's signature up front at the beginning of the process, so that when they turn in their sheets, then they don't all have to go on a rush for exemplars, because that's what's happening right now. It's sort of chaotic. We'll pull sheets where we're unsure about the signature of the circulator. They have to run off and find exemplars. We give them so much time to do it. That process would be more orderly if folks were registering with us up front, giving us their signature, and attesting that they had received some training. I think that accomplishes two good things at one time. We are very supportive of getting rid of the requirement that all signatures on a sheet be voters from the same county. That just isn't necessary anymore. There's no good public policy reason for it anymore now that we have a centralized voter registration system. And I think that will do a lot to assist chief petitioners with this irritation about having to lose so many signatures because of that issue. We would like the statute to be changed so that either the county clerk or the secretary can verify the signatures, however. At least some county clerks are interested in retaining that responsibility, and we believe we can work out a system where we can get rid of this requirement of single county sheets, and the counties can continue to verify signatures. I want to address just briefly this whole issue about crossing out names, and could you cross out a name any longer? My belief is that the Dash 1 amendments, we looked at this yesterday, are constructed as such that chief petitioners could continue to cross out names, and it would not violate the other section of the bill about you're not to alter the information that a signer puts on it. On a sheet. I wanted to show you this packet of signature sheets just briefly, because this is the kind of thing we see when we review sheets. And I told you the last time I talked to you that when we review sheets, we're looking for a review of the circulator sign and date rules, and can we tell what has happened with that sheet? And I think you can look at each sheet in this packet, and it's fairly clear to tell. These were all submitted by petitioners and ones that we disqualified. We just could not tell by looking at this what happened with that sheet. The top one, somebody named Andrew Templeman crossed it out and replaced it with initials. We can't really tell who circulated that sheet. Whose initials are those? The second one, there's a stamp that says that Jeremy Ravencroft circulated that petition, and it was signed by someone named Shelley Teedy, who I think we had testimony on before. That, you know, we can't take that. And look at the handwriting up above. This is a classic case of where a writer came in and wrote in the information later. And we see this a lot. And I'd like to repeat the problem that we had is that these companies hire so-called writers to come behind and do this, and they spell the names wrong in the printed version. And people's signatures, because you can't necessarily read the signature itself, the whole signature is thrown out because they've misspelled the name, and the people doing the verification can't find it in the system. The third sheet is another example. Initially signed by someone, crossed out, another name is placed on there. Who circulated that? We can't tell that. We've got so little time and so many sheets to go through that we can't stop and give a call to the chief petitioners and say, hey, can you straighten this out for us? That's why we write these rules in the initiative and referendum manual, make the rules clear to people at the beginning of the process, draw bright lines with the rules, and if you don't follow them, the sheet is not qualified. And I could go through the rest of these, but I don't think it's necessary. I think you get my drift. This is what we see a lot of. And these rules that are both in a rule and a statute are written for a purpose. There is a statute that says that these signatures are supposed to be witnessed. And that's the reason for that attestation at the bottom. If you don't follow that rule, then the sheets do not qualify to go towards counting for the petition. Correcting a problem is not difficult. If a circulator makes a mistake, we've made that very clear in the rules. You resign and you redate. And don't cross any stuff out or we won't be able to tell what's going on. Resign and redate. That is not difficult. I enjoyed the testimony particularly from Sarah Nashoff, who was an excellent manager of an initiative process. She understood the rules. She doesn't like them, but she understood them. We saw plenty of evidence in that petition that people understood the resign and the redate when she sent the signatures back to them, asked them to return them to her. She did an excellent job. She is proof that you can do it. And you can live within the rules and keep the process clean. So I'll hold my testimony there. And,
I wanted to ask you to comment on one of the things that a couple of witnesses mentioned, and that was this issue of somebody with a disability and whether they would have to register with the state in order to get assistance, as is specified in the Dash Ones.
Well, that's not the way I read the Dash One amendments. We have lots of provisions in election rules, elections that operate on an honor system, and I think we can start out with this one at least operating on an honor system and not require anything that's that onerous. This is something that we would recover in the training of the circulators, and if somebody is just simply incapable or needs assistance with signing a petition, that would be allowed. And we'd, if there were violations of this, we'd We deal with it on a complaint-driven basis. We also, as I testified in the last hearing, we now have an investigator who I intend to send out on the street and observe. I don't see this as the problem that was cited by some of the earlier folks who talked. Lots of people have different kinds of disabilities, and they could get help under this. Well,
questions from committee members, Representative Thatcher.
I'm ready.
Chair Buckley, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Thatcher, for putting over here. Mr. Limbeck, thank you very much. I've got questions around tension between honor system and cleanliness of the process and accountability of the process. So I hope you'll indulge. Can I ask a couple questions in this regard? Thank you, Madam Chair. What would be the purpose of having sequential numbers on the ballot? Again, the issue of not being able to Xerox more if you need, particularly if you're running a volunteer campaign.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for sequential numbering. We need it and we have required it for years, that the chief petitioners, when they bring in all the sheets and all those boxes, number them sequentially. We need it so that we can assure them, if any question arises, in part, that we didn't lose any, you know, that all the sheets are there that they turned in. Second, it's an administrative matter for us and our ability to track all those sheets at various parts of the process, and so that it helps us administratively. And third, I think it is an advantage for a chief petitioner to sequentially number the sheets so that they have more control over them and can track them as well. I don't think very many of them do it, but we didn't propose in our original bill. I don't think. If we did, we didn't mean to. In our original version of House Bill 2082, that anything other than that we would provide the templates rather than making the chief petitioners come back and forth to us, and that we didn't propose any changes to the sequential numbering requirement we now have, and that they sequentially number them when they turn them into us.
Very good. I appreciate that. Can you, on the honor system idea, the issue of having a date. I understand the desire to have it be witnessed, but is a date necessary if we can take an honor system on part of it? Couldn't we take, if the sheets are only fresh or only valid for a certain length of time, why do we need to have a date on that?
Well, the date's very important. The date tells you that they provides evidence for you that they indeed witnessed all the signatures rather than leaving it on a counter somewhere. But also we needed the date, and we instituted that in order to enforce Measure 26. Our penalties for Measure 26 are based on violations for a signature sheet. We can't pull together the evidence we need between signature sheets and dates and payroll records without a readable date and a clear date that's written on the sheet by the circulator.
Two more? If I can.
Go ahead.
Given in the proposal that the idea that we'd have a different template for volunteer and template for paid, would there therefore still be a need? And I understand the witnessing, but if we're taking someone's signature as their honor, right, their word of honor by signing that they had witnessed it, aren't we adding to the volunteer effort an extra requirement of having to have the date on there as another way that can possibly somehow mess up on the volunteer side?
That's an interesting question, whether we would want to make a distinction between paid and volunteer on the date issue. I don't think so. I think it's just not that hard for people to do and to do it correctly, and it helps us in terms of evidence of the witnessing issue. Whether you're paid or volunteer, you're required to witness those signatures.
I'm kind of from the hanging Chad school here, but I want the Chads to be counted. Just one more question on the idea of the rolling 2 years, would that not alleviate some of the pressure that you have in the July of the even number of years?
Yeah, we're very warm to that idea. We've been warm to that idea for a long time. About, you know, that takes a constitutional change because a lot of these requirements are in the Constitution. But giving people a year or 2 years to circulate their petition once they've received that final approval to circulate would sort of spread out the workload for us and sort of hopefully alleviate that crush that we see in July of even numbered years. I think we would still have somewhat of a crush in that it's sort of human nature that you're going to wait till the last second and that people will have an interest in getting their initiatives on that next general election ballot so they don't have to wait another 2 years. And so there would be somewhat of a crush at the end, but I do believe that that it would even it out more and make things less onerous in July of even numbered years.
Thank you, Ms. Limbeck. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Buckley, for asking some of the questions that I was burning to ask as well. But I do have some additional ones, so if you will oblige me, I appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll start with the date thing, since we're just talking about that. You said it's real important to enforce Measure 26 and to make sure that all witnesses were attested to or witnessed. Why not have a checkbox for the... I mean, there's already on the petition sheets people that they're signing when they sign. I mean, there's a place to date it by your signature. So that date's already there. And why couldn't you just have a little checkbox saying I attested the signatures rather than being tripped up all over the date, just kind of like we do when we register to vote. We check little checkboxes attesting that we're eligible voters.
That would not assist your referee, which is me, with enforcement of Measure 26. We need to be able to tie sheets to payroll records. And the only way to do that is to have a date on the sheet to be able to tie it to the date for which they were paid.
Follow up? So what you're saying is they date it for February 16th, 2007. They're paid on February 16th, 2007?
How can I explain this? Violations of Measure 26 are based on, your penalties are based on how many signature sheets were at issue and when you circulated them. If we don't know when you circulated them, how could we prove that there was a violation of Measure 26? The date by the signers is not required. The only thing that a signer under current law is required to put on the sheet is their signature. They're not required to put anything else on the sheet.
And that leads me to why is it so important that it be the signer that fills out all that information that isn't required?
Because the people who are doing it are getting it wrong. And we've actually had sheets where somebody has come along behind and obscured information, written new dates over it. We have a basic problem with our petition process in Oregon in that it has been historically so wide open that chief petitioners haven't felt the need to truly manage their petitions. And that's why it's encouraging for me to sit in these hearings and hear from someone like Sarah Nashef, who does a really good job of managing a petition. And we didn't see sheets like the ones that I just gave you in that packet that are a total mess, and it's impossible for us to figure out from her petition because she did a very active job managing it. She didn't like it, but it's very doable. It is not; these are not onerous requirements.
On that line, you were asked by Representative Buckley if it would prevent chief petitioner from crossing out known bad names, and you said you don't read the rule that way. Well, apparently some other people are reading the rule that way, and it just goes to show you how interpretations can enter in, even on these what you call non-onerous
Well, what would you like us to do, Representative Thatcher? Have no rules?
No.
Have it wide open so that people can just submit anything? I don't think that would be very good.
Okay. Follow-up, then. I'm saying is that rules can be interpreted differently, and they are apparently problematic, and that's what has been testified to. It would seem like it would be, I mean, like, for instance, I see this as a signature. I don't think those are initials. I look at it as a signature, and does it match the voter registration or the exemplar that was submitted to you? That would be what would be most important to me. And then on page 3 that you showed where you weren't sure what the circulators, what happened there. I mean, somebody must have signed the wrong sheet.
We have 3 names on that sheet. We have Patrice Ward, William something up above, and then William that we can't read, and then William Lewis. We have 2 names. Even if it was just 2 names, it's a problem. Who circulated it?
Right. I guess.
And on what date?
I guess what to me seems the most important are these signatures up here valid? Were they even checked?
Well, then let's get rid of the statute that they be witnessed. Because if this is totally unimportant and the legislature decides we don't need witnessing of the signatures, we don't care, get rid of it. There's a statute that requires that they be witnessed.
Okay.
In regards to your question about, I mean, if we looked at the Dash 1 amendments last night, and I was looking for that issue about could you cross it out, and there's language in there that says that the part about you can't change or alter or write in is applies to signatures submitted for verification. And if it is crossed out, it is not a signature submitted to us for verification. And that's why I don't think there's a problem with that in the Dash 1 amendments.
Good. Thank you. And I had a question from the previous testimony from Sarah Nash, if she was saying that approximately 8% or 10% or signatures are thrown off the top. Can you explain what she might be talking about there?
I know what she's talking about. She's talking about the statistical sampling process. We don't do full verification of signatures in Oregon because, obviously, with 30 days, if we were to go through and try to verify every signature on every petition, we would need a lot more time than that, and you'd have to give me a whole lot more money. And so we do statistical sampling. And in that process, a statistical sampling of signatures, we do what we call a first sample of just 1,000 from each petition. And if they don't make it qualify for the ballot on the first sample, it goes, that sample is expanded to up to 5% of their total number of signatures turned in. And we do it again. When Sarah Nash's petition made it on the first sample, because she had such a high validity rate and she did such a good job of managing her petition, but statute requires us, and this is written in the statute, to assume that in that first sample, 8% of the signatures in a first sample are duplicates, and that's written into the statute. If you go to a second sample, we are required to account for the actual number of duplicates in the second sample. The reason, and I could bring our statistician who consults with us on this, we have an excellent statistician who's consulted with the Secretary of State for many years. The reason why there needs to be an assumption about a duplicate rate in the first sample is that because the sample is so small, you couldn't statistically apply the actual duplicate rate to it. And so the past legislatures have decided that you need to assume that there are some duplicates in there and that an 8% duplicate rate is a fair number. Does that help?
Thank you. I just didn't understand what that process was, so yeah. I appreciate that. And I do have one more question.
I do think she's right, by the way, when she said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but she said her duplicate rate was actually higher than it indicated because her petition was so clean. I'm sure she was over 90%, but because that 8% was applied in the formula, it made it look lower than it was.
Interesting.
Final question.
Going back to, I saw a sheet that Jason Williams showed us earlier. I think it had an address sticker next to it, and it has the information there. It's very clear. It's easy to read. Would something like that be unacceptable?
I don't have the sheet in front of me, but
it basically looks like a label.
Not
it's like an address label.
Not last time.
Oh, that's by a signer. And the only thing that's required, again, by the signer to be placed on a sheet is their signature. And so the signers can basically leave it blank or do anything they want up there. And so, yes, that we would not reject the signature for that reason. Sorry.
I guess I'm trying to understand if now it wouldn't, but under the Dash 1 amendments, I'm concerned it might be. Because it appeared that they would have to fill in that information themselves. Am I mistaken?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, there would have to be, you know, I think our assumption would be that the signer put it there. And that, you know, unless somebody could prove to us otherwise.
Thank you. Thank you. Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'll indulge me a minute, I'd like to ask Mr. Lindbeck about the packet and some of the specifics on, for instance, were all of these rejected?
Yes.
And the top one was rejected. Why?
Because
of the cross out?
Well, there was a cross out there, and your cross outs always are a problem in that you can't tell really who circulated the sheet when there's a cross out, and then there's a set of initials there that we were unable to verify. Now, what we normally do is we try to go and find an exemplar for that circulator, and if the exemplar matched, it could have stayed in, but the cross out was a second.
Are volunteers required to have exemplars also?
It is.
If we can't read the signature, if we can't read the signature and there's a question about whether or not that's a legitimate signature or a minimum of a first initial and the last name, we will look for an exemplar for them.
So are volunteers required to have exemplars or only paid?
If exemplars are necessary, if we can't tell that there's a first initial and a last name there for anybody, we go and we look for an exemplar. Because the rule says you have to have a minimum of a first initial and a last name so that we can read it.
In the signature
mm-hmm.
of the
circulator.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, though, right now, you're not required to provide an exemplar ahead of time, regardless
no.
of whether you're paid or not.
That's
right?
Correct.
So this would have been rejected, and could it have been sent back to Mr. Templeman and had him, I mean, is there any corrective action? No time, no place?
No time. I mean, if you want to give us 2-3 months to do this.
But here's what is getting me on this. No, the first one. It calls for the circulator's signature. Okay. That is his signature.
I don't know. Is it?
Well, it's the same one as in line one.
Same guy.
Yeah. We apparently couldn't verify that.
Tax rolls.
Well, I mean, again, given time,
this is, you know, you and I have had conversations about. All right, let's go on. All of these were rejected. So let's go to another one I have a question on. Under current rules, okay, The one from sheet number 73, it's about the fourth or fifth one down. Michael Parker is the signifier.
I'm sorry, how far down?
Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the fifth one down.
Yeah.
Okay, this was rejected because of the crossouts?
Well, there's a crossout. It says Griggs under it, and then there's Michael Parker.
Okay, so that would reject it now.
Yeah.
So what?
Who circulated it?
Well, so what do we need a new statute if this would have been rejected? What's different in the dash ones?
Nothing. We're arguing here over sign and date rules that are not they're not part of this bill. They've just been raised as an issue in this hearing.
Okay, so
there's nothing about the dash one amendments that would affect any of these.
Would have affected any one of these.
Right.
These are ones, so in a sense, the system's working currently in terms of the rejection of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted, you know, there were a number of speakers that raised the sign and date rules as an issue. House Bill 2082 doesn't change them. The Dash 1 amendments don't change them. I just wanted to answer some of those issues and provide you more information.
Okay, so there's really nothing, there's nothing in the Dash 2 that would have changed the rejection of any of these.
No, and I wouldn't argue that there should be.
A couple other things that I had. That helps me a lot, because I'm trying to say, well, if they were rejected, what is the problem?
Right.
Background checks for
yes.
paid petitioners. It seems to me, and because I don't have good scale on this problem, how many are paid, how I mean, I can see it would be an issue, and I have no problem with saying that you have to not have been convicted of fraud. I don't have any objection to that. But it's my understanding that under the Dash 1s, you would be doing the background checks and you would be doing the training, meaning your office?
Well, the way the Dash 1s are written is that it says that as I recall, the secretary may not register an applicant who has been convicted for a criminal offense involving fraud, forgery, or identification theft. That suggests to us that it is incumbent on us in this registration process to do some sort of criminal background check up front in the registration process. That's not something we proposed. But
can I just clarify one thing, though?
Yeah.
In this registration process, in the Dash 1s, part of what the applicant fills out is that information.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose you might feel a need to verify what they're telling you, but they are asked to tell you if they've been convicted.
Yeah, I think the language that was a concern for us is the secretary may not,
right.
Which means is there some sort of liability on us if somebody doesn't tell the truth and we haven't done a background check.
So that leads me to where I'm going here. Is there some way to change this so that the background checks, you know, are required, but instead of you checking on them by rule, they are by exception. In other words, if there is some question about a signature gatherer, a paid one, then the company that is hired and paid them would have to show that they have done that background check rather than you checking on every one of them. Is there some way we could change the language in here to have that a better... It just seems less of an imposition on everybody and more of a system of by rule rather than by exception and having you check on everybody. I would suggest that too. The training issue that was taken out that you want put back in is a similar thing. What's stopping you now from having a website on training and do you have one?
We don't, and there is nothing stopping us, and I intend to do that regardless.
And I would strongly encourage that, and then at the same time you could say that if you are a paid petitioner that whoever hires you would be required to document your training rather than you being, you meaning the Secretary of State's office, actually do the documentation. And then it's along the same line. These are just some suggestions. And I didn't understand, excuse me, Madam Chair, I had all these, I didn't understand the exemplar part. And when you said chief petitioners have to keep bringing in and bringing out and you checking, when you were talking about the sequential
templates.
The templates, right. Yeah. How does that work now? I didn't get that.
Here's the way it works now. I think it's pretty inefficient for the chief petitioners. You go through the ballot title process. You've gone through legal issues. You finally get your ballot title. Then you're ready to get your signature sheets approved, your petition sheets approved. Right now, it's required that the chief petitioners actually come up with templates of their signature sheets in accordance with state law and present them to us for approval. And we will look at them and say, nope, you missed this and this and this. Go back and do it again. And it's not unusual for the chief petitioners to try to do this three or four times. And we keep having to say no because, you know, all of this stuff, the petition process, as you can tell, is there's a lot of rules and regulations. That's just the way it is. And so we keep sending them back, and they resubmit them. And, you know, it takes a while for them. We thought that it would be easier for everyone involved if we just did them and gave them to them.
And
follow up?
Yeah, thank you. And I thank you for that explanation, and that makes a lot of sense. But at the same token, sequentially, what you're handing them is a template, but
right.
They can copy it.
That's right.
And so,
and then we ask them, we require them to sequentially number them when they turn them on.
Okay.
And we're suggesting that stay the same, that part, but that we do the template sheets for them rather than make them run back and forth trying to get approval from us.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And one further question, explanation and that's around the county clerk. You comment that county clerks can do some of this. How does that work?
Well, right now, it used to be that each county had their own voter registration system and their own database. And so we would go through and we would figure out which signatures were selected in the random statistical sampling to be verified. And then we physically pack up the sheets and we send them to the county, and they have their people verify that that signature on the sheet matches the signature in the voter registration database.
Mm-hmm.
Now that it's all one big database, there is no need for any of that process anymore, really, particularly the requirement that the chief petitioners can only have signatures on a sheet where all the people live in the same county. I believe them that that's onerous. I'm sympathetic to that, and I don't believe it's necessary anymore for them to do that. But I don't have, frankly, the resources or the people right now to verify all those signatures. And so the counties are interested in retaining that authority, a lot of them. They would like to continue to do it. And if they're willing and want to continue to do it, I'd like to retain that option that the county clerks actually verify the signatures on the petition rather than us. Or you guys can give me a bunch of money to do it.
But they would do it using the central database,
yes.
And not be just limited to their counties.
Correct.
I got it. Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense.
Okay, right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Roblin.
Thank you very much. First, to follow up on that one. So you're saying, from the template standpoint, once the templates are made and they can print their own sheets, and you don't have
yes.
a problem with that. Okay,
yes.
That's nice to hear. The other question: when Sarah Nash was here, mm-hmm. one of the reasons that she felt her petitions were as clean as they were is that even when a person wrote in and you couldn't read their address, they would fill out above that, they'd put the right address in well printed so that you could verify that in case you couldn't read theirs. Mm-hmm. In our current rendition, that would make that not a valid signature, as I understand it, because they would have been tampering with the stuff that they've already done.
Let me make sure I understand the question.
Can they go over and make a note above the address?
Yes.
Even with the place yes. written?
The issue is that they can't alter or change the information on the petition sheet so that we can't tell what was written there. We've never stopped petitioners from making notations on the sheet that would help us. We've never stopped that.
And this would, and as you read this bill, that would not change here.
No.
Okay.
And I guess I had a question then from that. So if somebody makes a mistake when they're filling this out, is there anything that prevents them from just crossing out the entire line that they signed on and then doing it again on
no.
the next line? And
no.
that's pretty commonplace, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I want to go over, I just want to make sure that I have all of the changes that you've suggested. You wanted us to make it clear that the effective date for the ballot title shopping provision was not until the 2010
cycle,
election
yeah.
cycle. I wanted to go back to the original language in Section 5 on templates.
Right.
You wanted us to restore the training provision from the original bill, which was inadvertently left out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like us to have it be optional to have the county clerks or the Secretary of State, either one could do
right.
verification process. And I know there were other clarifications and some issues that you raised, such as the money mm-hmm. for doing background checks, but those were the actual changes that would make this
yes.
conform with what you intended.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony and for hanging in there. That completes our lists of people signed up to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify today? Okay. I think we do have still some other public testimony of people that could not be here today, so we will be taking this up again on Monday, and I wanted to assure committee members, and this is why we're having multiple hearings on this bill, that we're allowing ample time to consider input, changes. Committee members who want to see changes in the bill should get those to me or to the committee administrator, and we will be continuing to move forward on this bill as we can.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I did. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't neglecting. I got an email this morning about 5 minutes before the committee that from an individual who wanted his testimony entered on the record, and I guess we can just make copies of it. Or
if you give that to the committee administrator, then I think.
Okay.
Mr. Stembridge,
yes, we'll make sure that you
that?
Have copies on. Is Monday going to be satisfactory to store copies to the
we have it posted again for
we'll,
Monday.
We'll include it in your packet on Monday, and we'll make it available for the public to get copies of it on Monday, and we'll make it a part of today's record.
Great. Okay, so it'll become part of the record, and we will make copies, distribute them to committee members, and have them out for the public on Monday at our hearing. Thank you. Great. Thanks a lot. And seeing nothing further to come before us, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2082, and the committee is adjourned.
Thank you.